you cannot just go with the flow and expect things are going to work out in terms of like the real priorities, the real important things in life. And especially for marriage and family, you have to very consciously, you know, decide what you want and plan. Like, use your brain. Like, yes, you can use your brain to have a career in this and that and the other, but use your brain for, you know, what's actually going to be at the core of your life. And that is your husband and family. You know, plan it out and go to a place where there's like-minded people, make a good choice, you know, work with somebody who is willing to set up a life that will make you happy. You know, if you want to stay home with your kids for several years or whatever, or do a little bit of both, like find the right person in a very conscious, mindful way.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Girl Boss Interrupted. I'm Helen Roy, and I am so excited to introduce this very special episode. Today, I'll be speaking with Maya Sinha, author of a novel I recently read called The City Mother, published by Chrism Press. This is one of those books I consumed all at once, a great example of fiction being truer than reality. I'm going to read the synopsis to give you a taste. Fresh out of college, small-town crime reporter Kara Nielsen sees disturbing things that suggest for the first time in her life that evil is real. But as the daughter of two secular academics, she pushes that notion aside. When her smart, ambitious boyfriend asks her to marry him and move to a faraway city, it's a dream come true. 4 years later, confined to a city apartment with a toddler, Kara feels she is losing her mind. Sleeplessness, isolation, and postpartum hormones have altered her view of reality. Something is wrong in the lost, lonely world in which she's brought a child. Visions hint at mysteries she can't explain, and evil seems not only real, it's creeping even closer. As her marriage falters and friends disappear, Kara seeks guidance from books, films, therapy, even the saints, when she's not scrubbing the diaper peel. Meanwhile, someone is crying out for help that only she can give. Kara must confront big questions about reality and illusion, health and fitness, good and evil, and just how far she's willing to go to protect those she loves. I hope you enjoy this episode with the brilliant Maya Sinha. If you do, please be sure to like, subscribe to, and share this episode with your friends. Chat soon.
Okay, here we go. So, Maya Sinha, welcome to Girl Boss Interrupted.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
So as I just said in my introduction, Maya is the author of the amazing book, which I actually have right here, The City Mother, from Chrism Press, I believe. I want to start by letting Maya introduce herself as an author, because it kind of, I think, lends some insight into her inspiration for the book. So Maya, tell us a little bit about yourself, please.
Sure. I grew up in a little town in New Mexico, and for a while I was a journalist in Santa Fe. And then I went to law school out in California, and pretty much since then I've been a practicing lawyer, but I've also done a lot of freelance writing on the side. I had a humor column in the local paper for a while, and then I had a humor column in the Saturday Evening Post. Humor was sort of like the fun outlet from my legal work and everything else. And I've also written essays and humor pieces. And The City Mother is my first novel, though I have written fiction for a long time. And it was published by Chrism Press, a sort of great new indie Catholic fiction publisher. And that's it for me.
Yeah. So could you tell us now a little bit about the plot of the book and who is Kara? So I'll just give that first piece away. Kara is the main character here. Who is she, and what's her journey like? Could you share that?
Sure, of course. Kara Nielsen is the main person in the novel. It's told from her point of view. And she's a small town newspaper reporter. She grows up as an only child, meets her husband-to-be, who's also a newspaper reporter, who's a smart, ambitious guy, and they move to the city, an unnamed city in the United States. And they enjoy everything city life has to offer, you know, movies, restaurants, shopping, all sorts of activities. And then within a couple of years, they have a baby, and then they have another baby. And the novel is about the radical change that creates in her life and how she has to sort of rethink, you know, what her values are, what life is about, and also the sort of the terror of just being a new mother, sort of unprepared for it in a city, which is an isolating environment, And there's all sorts of spiritual and psychological changes and changes to her marriage that come along in the course of motherhood. So that's the novel. And I like to say it's a literary novel in that it's a novel of ideas, but it's also, it has the elements of genre fiction, like psychological suspense, like a kind of domestic noir where there's something sort of suspenseful and mysterious going on. So I hope it's a really fun, engaging read.
Yes, it, well, I can vouch for that. It certainly is. You know, it kind of, there were so many different influences that I could detect. As a Walker Percy fan, I definitely recognized the moviegoer and just Walker Percy in general. A little bit of Sylvia Plath. Like, I kind of feel like The Bell Jar was a bit of an Urbanite Interrupted storyline. And that kind of, I kind of see that here too. And the way that you sort of highlight the main mundane to make bigger points about society and gender and the rest feels very Welbeckian as well. So I want to ask, you know, who are your literary influences?
Well, thank you for calling it Welbeckian. That's a huge compliment. And I'm happy that I can even pronounce that word and know what it means. But I really like Welbeck's novels, even though they're like sort of terrible and depressing in a way. They're also quite funny. And I would say my main literary influence is someone similar to that, and that's Martin Amis, the British writer who wrote sort of a nihilistic comedy in the 80s and 90s. And I read him a lot when I was in my 20s. And he was so funny. And he really could bring kind of this cerebral, ironic, funny take to just the mundane facts of life. He was a hilarious writer. And then the other people I often cite are the Catholic convert Muriel Spark, who was an amazing comic writer, but very dark humor. And her novels are beautifully crafted and almost minimalist novels. And yet she tells these very psychologically and spiritually complex stories set in modern times. And then the third person I like to cite, just for sort of general readability and craft, is Agatha Christie. I started reading her novels in seventh grade, and she also tells amazing, you know, as we all know, I mean, very suspenseful, well-crafted stories that are quite interesting within very clear, crisp language. And so Martin Amis and Agatha Christie are sort of at opposite ends of the spectrum, but I tried to sort of have a happy medium of having a brainy novel that was also like fast-paced and readable.
I think you succeeded. this is one of my favorite novels that I've read all year. I've been sort of attracted to these kind of heady female experiences. And it's kind of rare that you actually come across that. Like, well, it's never the subject of a Welbeck book is like a woman, right?
All the women in his books are Thai prostitutes. Like, well, I don't relate to that, but
yeah, he's saying something about women, but but yeah. So I mean, and so I really did enjoy it. And what was I going to ask you? Oh yeah, I also sort of noticed that you, as well as having these literary influences, seem to be fascinated, at least the main character is, by poetry and film. And so, you know, what role do those things play? And where does that come from? Is that a personal interest as well?
Yeah, that's drawing a little bit on my personal background. I mean, I was an English major, and I went to work for a weekly newspaper in Santa Fe. And I ended up doing a few movie reviews just because, you know, I just sort of chose to do that. And I only maybe did 6 or 7 in total, but that always was the best possible job to me, was to go to the movies in my 20s, sit there and then write about it. And for this character, I mean, I really, I try to emphasize that with her. She was like more of a movie reviewer than I ever was, but she's captivated by imaginative, artistic works. And she's always sort of trying to make sense of her own life. And so she's somewhat isolated through the book. She's home with these little kids, but what she has is her imagination and this store, this mental store of, poetry and literature and music. And then she goes to the library and she reads about the saints. And so she's always sort of feeding her imagination and feeding her intellect, even though she's sitting in a house, you know, with a diaper pail and a baby and a toddler. And I think that's actually very realistic. I mean, you don't think of really the intellectual journey of a mother of young kids, but that's legit. Like that really happens, you know? And you can have a very sophisticated cerebral experience even with your baby in your lap. And I feel like that should be honored a little bit more, that women can be both of those things at once.
I couldn't agree more. So you mentioned her imagination. There's something deeply Catholic about it that as a Catholic myself, more of a revert, actually. I was a cradle Catholic, was not catechized. I had like one good catechesis class when I was like 13. And those people who did that I will always love them, but it was 1 year of my life and it just wasn't enough. And so I had like a major reversion not long ago. But there's something about the Catholic worldview, maybe the Catholic imagination, as I've said, that always sort of drew me toward that question of what's true, drew me toward beauty even. And also made me a little bit fascinated with evil as well. Do you think that there is a specifically Catholic sort of imagination or worldview that Kara is participating in? And if so, could you just describe that or lend some insight into that?
Sure. I mean, so Kara grows up in a basically an atheistic home. Her parents are professors, and she like many professors' kids or the kids of the educated class, they're middle class strivers or upper middle class strivers, and their job is to go out into the world and succeed and get the good job and have, you know, status and have a nice house and sort of secure their place in that class. But there's not much of a there's really no religious aspect to that, or religious, you know, or deeper meaning than, you know, go out there and, you know, go get them. So anyway, so having a baby for her is a serious reality check into what she's supposed to be doing and what she actually wants and needs to do, which is to focus on her child, which is a profound experience. And the way that ties into Catholicism to me, she's not Catholic at the time. She has no interest in being Catholic, but the novel traces her increasing, her identification in a way with these Catholic themes and Catholic figures. And G.K. Chesterton, who is also like a funny, down-to-earth, really modern person in a way, he talks about Catholicism and the truths of Catholicism being, you know, normalcy, reality, common sense. Like the more of a reality check you have, the more you're kind of like, oh, you know, this Catholic stuff kind of makes sense to me now. And so that her contact, or, you know, the rubber hitting the road of her life as a mother versus, you know, secular, materialistic, consumeristic life in the city, even that reorientation to some sort of normal, natural state of motherhood is a Catholic process. And it's kind of great to think about that now in 2022, being normal, being healthy, having any sort of morals, having any sort of common sense. You line up with the Catholic Church more than you line up with popular culture. You know, it's quite appealing because it appeals to your natural orientation toward the truth and toward beauty and, you know, and family, right? Those are kind of like everybody likes that stuff. So in a very almost unconscious or, you know, unintentional way, she gets closer and closer to the Catholic Church by having an encounter with the truth of her own being.
That was beautifully stated. I can certainly see that in the novel. I'm remembering now, like closer to the beginning, one of her, you know, hinge moments. It seems like she's in the city and she finds herself bored, and that's really this sort of Sylvia Plath thing that I'm getting. There's this urban ennui, and that just hits her, and she's like, okay, I want to have a baby. You know, she gets bored with the day to day, the restauranting, the consumer culture. And it's a show don't tell situation, but it's pretty obvious that sort of life is unfulfilling. It's why she decides that she wants to have a baby. But why do you think, why is that unfulfilling for Kara and unfulfilling in general? Why is this urban, consumer, secular liberal world that we all inhabit, why is it not enough for somebody who's thinking?
Yeah, it may be temporarily enough. It's certainly fun to get out of your small town and go somewhere where there's more experiences and opportunities and the scenery's better and the food is more diverse. I mean, that certainly has its place. I'm not knocking it. But you know, sooner or later, you know, one tires of hedonism and just sort of entertaining yourself and working so that you can entertain yourself. Most jobs, you know, with some exceptions, most jobs are not all that fascinating and compelling and really give you a sense that you're, you know, living your best life sitting at the office. And so then, you know, trying to enjoy yourself is enjoying the sort of hedonistic pleasures of the city. And again, that's all well and good, but it doesn't sustain you forever. And so Kara realizes quicker than most that the life she has been prepared for, which is, you know, earn and spend, like that's not her real job. I think that's how she puts it. Like, I have a real job, but this can't be it. You know, sitting and doing office work in a building all day. Is this my real job? Like, don't I have something better to do than this? And so just because of an experience she had in her past, encountering a couple of kids who were very charming and brought a sort of life and energy that she wasn't used to in the adult world, she sort of intuits that, yeah, maybe I should have a baby. You know, maybe that's the job. And it turns out that is the big job. That is the job that is challenging and important enough to be worthy of her.
Yes, and you do a great job too of showing how challenging that is. I mean, I'm currently in the thick of that. I could just feature very quickly, like very much in the thick of that. And so I could really appreciate certain images that you threw in there, like your 1,000-yard stare as you're cutting cucumbers at the counter or whatever, like stuff like that is like, this is so familiar, you know, and the way that you even describe like the baby, the way that a newborn's bowel movements sound. It's just so specific and so funny.
You're not going to get that a lot of places.
No, you really won't. You really won't. Like, and if you get it, you get it. But you're further removed from this. I feel like I have amnesia from a few hours ago. How did you remember and draw on these experiences?
That's a great question. And honestly, if I tried to go back and remember, you know, what it was like when my kids were, you know, babies and toddlers, I wouldn't have remembered. I don't remember to this day really that much what it was like. But luckily, I had two long periods of maternity leaves with my two kids who were born pretty close apart. They were born in 2007 and at the end of 2008. And so I had a couple of years where I was home a lot with my kids. And I was so stunned by the experience of having this baby. I was sort of like an analytical brain in a jar kind of person. And then I had these kids and life completely changed. And I had also been a writer, you know, my whole life in some capacity. So I took a lot of notes. I mean, literally I remember one time my son was a toddler running around. I had my baby and I had my laptop on the diaper changing table and was typing up really verbatim just a conversation I'd had with my little son and trying to get the texture of it down. You know, I didn't have time to write a novel or think about a novel, but just almost journaling like, wow, this is weird. Like this is new, you know? And anyway, years later, when I did have a little more time, I started thinking, you know, I'm gonna try and make this into a novel, but I had all the raw material preserved. And if nothing else, you know, as a writer, if you even have time to get anything down, you know, get it down and you can fix it later. You can craft it later.
Yes, that takes me back to one of the chapters, which I thought was so funny and so brilliant, which was essentially like a dialogue between Kara, the main character, and her eldest son, Charles, which is just him saying, mom, mama, like, you know, Stewie from Family Guy or whatever. The whole chapter, yes, Charles. It's funny to talk to these little people like adults, respond to them like adults when they're just shouting mama at you ceaselessly. So anyway. So let me ask you, when you started to write this novel, What did you have the whole story in mind? I mean, you say you had the snippets sort of ready, the memories ready, but how did the whole plot sort of hit you, or how did you develop the plot?
Yeah, you know, like I say, I had just read novels like, you know, Gone Girl and things like that. And I really like the idea of a novel that you want to stay up reading and turn the pages. And so I had a lot of internal, she's a very internal character. She's in her head a lot. Like we talked about, she's thinking about books and movies and this and that, but I also wanted it to move along. And so I just started reading books on the first thing I read actually was Rosemary's Baby, which is a domestic noir set in a city in an old building about a mother and her baby, totally different from my story. But I was just sort of looking at the tone of it and how to get suspense into it. And the one of the books I read had this sort of archetypal character called the female noir or the female gothic. And this character that comes up in some books is a woman who is out of place in her environment and through somehow has to solve a mystery and somehow heal her environment. And I really liked that idea. And I was able to create a plot, you know, with the sort of peaks and valleys of, you know, sort of suspenseful writing around this notion of a female noir or female gothic, where it's a female hero and a female sort of hero's journey that doesn't look like a male hero journey. And then the female is sort of a weird misfit in her environment. And yet, you know, she's somehow vindicated in the end. So anyway, that was my idea. And then to sort of mold the literary stuff and the idea stuff around that plot. And I just chipped away at it, you know, chapter by chapter. I had great help editing it and refining it. And then that the final product, you know, is what it is.
In the introductory episode to this podcast, and, you know, the reason that this podcast is named Girl Boss Interrupted is after Girl Interrupted, you know, the early 2000s movie where the characters end up in an asylum for sort of similar reasons. I mean, obviously not the same reasons, right? None of them are mothers, but they're sort of driven to insanity by a vision of womanhood and the expectations of womanhood in a society that really devalues and just hates women in a very basic sense, like hates the things about women that can elevate us to, they hate Mary, really, is what I'm sort of getting at. They hate the image of woman that is creative and good and virtuous. And so all of the expectations that are sort of placed on women now are oppose that image, right? We're expected to be sterile, promiscuous, and in a work environment, extremely masculine. So that's a theme that I just see all the time in my work. And I think it's part of the Catholic worldview. You know, I see this anti-Mary, as Carrie Gress puts it, everywhere. What do you think about that? Do you perceive that as well?
Yes. Although, you know, even to say that this society hates women, I mean, you know, it's complicated because there are a lot of opportunities for women that don't exist in Saudi Arabia or something like that. In a way, it's a very, the freedom and autonomy and, you know, wealth of this society is actually quite nice for women. Like I have a dishwasher, sure, and, you know, things like that, or I have, right, you know, medicines, but on a deeper level, yes, that femininity, specifically feminine qualities, are not acknowledged and are devalued. Just in the way you say, so that you can go through life, you know, with a very comfortable life and a good job and, you know, all the amenities of our modern society and still be very unhappy. And this whole thing about SSRIs that has just come out, I mean, that could not be better timed for this novel, because again, she's having problems adjusting to the position that she's been placed in, the fact that nobody really understands her and that society and her own family is not really set up for her to be a mother the way she wants to be. And that the message to her is, there's something wrong with you. Like, you have a chemical imbalance. You know, have you considered taking up yoga? you know, maybe you should, you know, meditate every day. You know, have you started, you know, juicing? Stupid. Like Women's Magazine solution to the fact that, you know, like it's not you, you know, it's not you that you want to be home with your baby instead of going back to work after 6 weeks. It's almost a rite of passage for the, you know, leave the baby in daycare, go back to work and spend the whole first day crying, you know, and oh, well, buck up. That's just how it is. The baby will be fine. This happens to us all. No, you know, like, sorry, like it's very upsetting and traumatizing. And like, what has happened that we have to do that now? So anyway, yes, I would agree with that. And just being feminine and just having the Catholic image of womanhood, the Catholic in many ways reverence of womanhood is a countercultural position. Again, it's natural, it's normal, it's sane. There's nothing weird about it. And yet it makes you countercultural in 2022.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've already just discussed the challenges of motherhood, motherhood of very young children, toddlers, babies. And that is a challenge. But do you think it's Kara's biggest challenge? Because I, as the reader, I have my own thoughts about this. But, you know, what is Kara's biggest challenge, in your opinion?
I would say her marriage. I mean, you know, the circle, the woman, the intimate circle of a woman, and really of any person, is their family. And especially when you have kids, you're very dependent on, you know, whatever your support system is, your you know, husband, your friends, your family. And so I think her biggest challenge is that her husband, who's the closest person to her, is also blindsided by the fact that everything has changed. He has not been prepared or equipped to really help her or support her. So that's tough. Her female, you know, friends and coworkers, again, do not really understand where she's coming from. You know, all the people that she looks to for support and understanding are not quite there for her in the way she needs them to be. So I think the isolation and the fact that nobody is really on her side, even though she's going through a very normal experience, wears her down over time and leads her into a crisis. And then, of course, she also has this, she has a perception that she's a chilling perception that, you know, your sense of evil and menace is heightened with a new baby. And so she's alone in the city a lot of the time with her baby. And it's very frightening and it's very unsettling, you know, what the world she has brought her baby in, the city of man, the city of sinfulness and, you know, hate. It's a rough world. It's a rough ride in this world. And so that is the sort of spiritual aspect to her psychological distress.
That's a good way to get into my next question. You've mentioned that, what was his name?
Martin Amis. Uh-huh. British writer. Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to have to pick some of his work up. But yes, this fascination with evil is sort of lightened, I guess you could say, by a lot of humor. So what do those two things have to do with one another?
Yeah, humor. I mean, I've always really liked funny novels. I don't have much patience for novels that are, you know, humorless, because I mean, humorless is just a big part of, humor is a big part of life and, you know, just sort of coping with what life throws at you. So even though the novel is about the spiritual reality of evil and the difficulty she has, you know, coping, there's also, of course, a lot of joy. I mean, like William Blake said, you know, joy and woe are woven fine, clothing for the soul divine. It's both, you know, and that's why you don't want a novel that is that's just a slog, you know, because a likable character has a little bit of levity and irony and perception about their situation that, well, parts of it are actually kind of funny. And so I did try to bring that into it, a sort of ironic, humorous cast of mind. You know, one minute, you know, she's changing a diaper, the next minute she's worried about, I mean, it's just all a mix, just like life is itself. And to me, I mean, sometimes when I describe the novel, it sounds very dark and grim and almost like, oh, it makes motherhood sound terrible. But motherhood is a great joy. And the absurdity of the situation one finds oneself in, you know, is kind of funny. And the fact that you're able to see that as you you know, make your way in the world. I don't know. I think that's just an important like quality of character. And I think it makes for a good novel.
Yeah, I agree. It it's both funny and grim. And that's part of what makes it so effective. It's compelling on both of those levels. So the marriage between Kara and her husband, Tim, this is a really interesting plot point, in my opinion, because it really gets to a challenge that a lot of women face now, which is, and you I think you portrayed him very charitably. But that being said, a lot of the men out there, and to be fair, too, I mean, Kara was this way when she married him, right? But a lot of the men out there are secular. They are careerists. This is just a people thing. Like I said, like Kara was like this when she married Tim. But when things changed for Kara, things did not change for Tim. And, you know, ultimately that's an interesting, it's just an interesting plot point. And it's an interesting fact of just living in our, the current society. Go on.
I was going to say that's right. And in a way you can't blame, you know, Kara or Tim or anybody else who's been raised in a secular way in the modern age, to have no sense of the gendered roles that they are supposed to assume, you know, within the family. Like Tim has been, you know, he's been, I mean, it's not gone into in the background, but, you know, he's been sitting next to girls in class his whole life, working with girls in class his whole life. And he has this very, you know, egalitarian mindset of we're both, you know, we're both workers. We're sort of fungible. And the idea that I'm supposed to protect my wife, care for my wife, support my wife while she is in turn caring for the baby, that was never introduced to him, just like it's not introduced to a lot of kids. And I, you know, I can tell you, like, raising my own teenagers now, like my son, when he was about 10, I was like, you know, Reed, it'd be really nice if you would open the door, you know, for me as I walked in. Like, it's good to learn, like your dad does it and your uncles do it. And that, you know, when it's nice to hold the door, like for, you know, Nana or whoever. And he literally did not understand why he, the boy, was supposed to hold a door for a woman. Like, why, you know? And well, it's tradition, but this idea of gendered roles, even kind of like just in sort of the social niceties, is so foreign to this generation and has sort of been like drummed out of them from the very beginning, that when a gendered role arises, that, okay, your wife is a mother and you are not, you know, then they're blindsided by it. And in a way, like Tim feels like it's been a huge bait and switch. Like, what do you mean you're not going back to work? You know, what do you mean we're not having equal time with the baby, you know? So, I think I tried to portray it charitably because in some way they have been formed to be this way by sort of a society that doesn't really respect, you know.
Yeah. And you know, we're formed by a society, but we're also meant to be formed, of course, by the older generations, by our parents. And, there's another part of the book when she's in the asylum and talking to her fellow, I don't want to say inmates. What would you say?
Patients.
Patients, right. Okay. And talking, going on one of her sort of rants about a movie, and it's Cinderella, right? And she, and the character makes this point, to the chagrin of the therapist, who just kind of wants to keep things moving. But she makes a really profound point that both the male character in Cinderella, Prince Charming and Cinderella, need mother and father figures to nudge them toward their happily ever after together. So the prince needs the king to say, hey, you're going to get married and I'm going to throw you a ball so you can find a wife. And Cinderella needs her fairy godmother. She needs the maternal role to facilitate that connection too. And that's a nice and interesting juxtaposition, you know, with Kara and Tim, who in many ways, both of them are motherless and fatherless. Kara in particular is motherless and Tim in particular is fatherless. And that sort of the way that ends and sort of plays out in their lives and their marriage. It's a really interesting point that I feel like you made. Were you trying to make that point?
Yeah, absolutely. And then in contrast, you know, Kara has her own daughter, her baby daughter, And she's very, I think there's one line in there saying, you know, she will not be flying blind, you know, not this one. Like, I'm going to figure this out and then I'm going to tell her about it. Because yes, in this maximalist society of maximal independence, maximal autonomy, I think the idea was you raise your children, you send them out into the world, and they choose their religion, they choose their spouse, they choose their job. It's none of your business. Hands off. Good luck to you. And there's very little sense of, you know, well, hierarchy, like I'm older and maybe I know a little bit more than you, and guidance, you know. And that can be cruel. Maximum autonomy can be cruel because life is not infinite. It's not Groundhog Day. You don't have, you know, 40 years through of trial and error to figure things out. Things like marriage, family, you know, you have a very limited period of time to figure them out. And with nobody really interested in telling you anything, or people who feel like for whatever reason they lack the moral authority to tell you how to live your life, that's really a handicap, I feel, if you don't have wise elders who are really interested in steering you down the right road. And of course, again, points naturally to the Catholic faith, the Catholic religion, multi-generational religion, so that everybody is on the same page. And you get guidance and continuity between the generations, which is sorely lacking now.
Yes. And another thing about Catholicism that I very much see in your book is that there's this sense of, like you said, a generational continuity. I mean, I say this as literally this past week, we celebrated the feast of Saint Anne, Mary's mother. And so there is that sense of belonging, even if it's not a direct, genetic blood belonging. There is the cloud of witnesses. Saints are friends who we can take on as, you know, mothers and cousins and sisters and brothers and friends. There's this togetherness and conviviality that is so so countercultural, considering the atomistic urban life and existence. And that's another element that I really appreciated in the book too. So this is more of a personal question, but are there any particular saints that you favor or that you sort of, you know, think about?
Yeah, I'm a convert. And so I'm so, in many ways, I'm getting to know, you know, the saints and the saints' days and all that. And I really love it just for the reason you say, because as a young secular person, you know, thrown into the world, you have a feeling of being alone and this sort of nihilism and despair, even in the comedy of young people. If you read like McSweeney's or something, like it's all these jokes about how alone they are, how meaningless life is, how, you know, they're never gonna. I mean, it's just like the comedy of despair, honestly, even the jokes. And so then you contrast that with the sort of natural, normal, wholesome, sensible, you know, Catholic culture of you're not alone. Like, don't kid yourself. You're not some, you know, totally unique alien on the planet. Like, there's been a lot of human beings, and we know how to do this more or less. Like, maybe it's difficult to do, but there's a whole blueprint. And, you know, you have people, you have history, people, saints, role models, generations, the church, you know, so many people like on your side and on your team. Tap into that. You know, you're not just this atom, you know, bouncing around in Brownian motion by yourself. So again, it's countercultural, but in a very good way to be able to tap into that. And for me, Saint Monica had a lot of appeal. The mother of Saint Augustine. I mean, I just love her because she's such a trooper, and she comes off as kind of a nag, you know, and she's a mom, you know, and she will not. And her husband is secular. Her son doesn't want to listen to her, and yet on her deathbed, you know, she's been so faithful and so determined and so dedicated that she says, you know, I don't even know why I'm still, or I guess she wasn't on her deathbed yet. I don't even know why I'm still alive because everything I wanted has happened. And her faithfulness and determination, her, you know, knowing what the truth is, even if her own family is, you know, not quite up to speed. I mean, I just find that very, not only admirable, but that is the modern predicament, you know, that to be so, to know what the truth is, even though, yeah, it, to be a woman, it, to be to suffer, to suffer because of, in a way, your children and your, you know, just to have your heart suffer because, you know people are going the wrong way. I mean, she's just so relatable, and yet she sticks to her guns.
That's a good way to sort of transition into the final part of all my interviews, which I want to include you in. A lot of young people, because of the reasons that we've already discussed, are desperate for life advice. Desperate to you know, there's like a whole movement on TikTok of millennial people calling themselves cycle breakers. And you know, gentle parenting, it's part of this whole thing, this whole sort of grassroots movement that I'm trying to document. And it's coming from a lot of different directions. It's not all Christian. It's not all, you know, conservative. It's in fact, a lot of it is like hippie type, you know, crunchy, all that. I mean, and I'm there, believe me.
I love it. I love that there's so much common ground between like conservative Catholics and like crunchy hippies. Like there's so much, it's great that there's an overlap because they are converging again on the sensible natural truth from different directions. But anyway, yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, yeah, no, it's so true. But anyway, the point that I'm trying to make is that the people are really needing advice. And another thing that I appreciate about your novel, and I'll stop fawning over it once I'm finished here, but it was that there's a deep moral message, but it's not moralizing at all. But yeah, we'll just put that aside. Okay, so young people are looking for advice. What advice do you have for young people? I mean, what do you tell your teenagers?
Yeah, well, I'm really, thank you. You know, it's an honor even to be asked that question. I'm certainly not an expert on anything, but I think my main, that I tell my own kids who are teenagers, and I especially talk to my daughter about it because I know the female journey so well. I know the pitfalls of it and what you're going to encounter. I mean, I have a pretty good idea what she's heading into. So I talk to her a lot, and thankfully she's very receptive to that message. And that is, you cannot just go with the flow and expect things are going to work out in terms of like the real priorities, the real important things in life. And especially for marriage and family, you have to very consciously, you know, decide what you want and plan, like use your brain. Like, yes, you can use your brain to have a career in this and that and the other, but use your brain for, you know, what's actually going to be at the core of your life. And that is your husband and family, you know, plan it out and go to a place where there's like-minded people, make a good choice. You know, work with somebody who is willing to set up a life that will make you happy. You know, if you want to stay home with your kids for several years or whatever, or do a little bit of both, like find the right person in a very conscious, mindful way. And it doesn't need to look like what anybody else is doing. You have to know your values and find somebody like-minded so that you can build a life that makes sense for you. And I'll just leave you with one image. I mean, my daughter's 13. She's super smart. She could do anything, right? But do I focus on that? No. Do I focus on her, you know, career path and should she go into STEM? No, because that's all going to take care of itself. Like she'll figure it out and she'll be good at something and she'll do it. But you know, the other day we were at Mass, sitting in front of us was a multi-generational family of the two grandparents, two adult children, their spouses, and they had this baby who was about 7 months old, this little boy who was squirming his way through Mass. And they spent the whole hour passing this little boy back and forth among six adults. And every one of them would hold him and give him a kiss, pass him to grandma, hold him, give him a kiss. Then he wants mommy. Then he wants his aunt. And just the love of that family. You know, I told my daughter, like, that is my dream for you. Not, you know, which office will you be sitting in working for which company? Like that is the dream, you know, from my perspective. And I wish I had that. And that's what I want for you. And keep your eye on the ball of what is really going to matter in your heart and soul. You know, jobs come and go, but that would be my advice.
It's a much more human way of life.
Yeah.
I have the same dreams for my daughters. I really hope that they don't get swept up in these sort of fake, this fake mimesis, this sort of fake but really dull, low-hanging aspirations that are sort of manufactured. I'm sorry if you can hear this swing creaking in the background. Oh, it's been a really chaotic morning.
Well, and just to go back to an optimistic point, sometimes I feel like I just, you know, I'm sort of, you know, complaining about our society, but actually our society has so many opportunities for girls. I mean, that will take care of itself. If you're smart, ambitious, motivated girl, like you will find your place in the world of work and the work of, in the contributing to society. I have no doubt, you know, you really can do both, but that, you know, that is in a way easier to come by, checking the boxes of work and getting where you want up the, you know, ladder of work. The hard thing is building a family and a home. And a religion and something really nourishing to your inner life and your core being, you know, but both will work out. The smart girls, you know, don't, I mean, if they're so lucky in so many ways, if they have their head on straight and know what's important.
Sorry, my microphone malfunctioned. Yes, and you know, there's a lot of doom and gloom sort of in the world now with the news and everything, which is another theme in the novel. But I actually think it's a wonderfully hopeful time to be a woman and have any inkling of the truth, have any inkling of what's important to you, because I just feel like never. I mean, yes, there are all these pressures. It's the mainstream path is a certain path. But if you have the grace of seeing through that, if you have that discernment, then there is absolutely nothing stopping you from achieving really what you want, what you want to achieve. The average is going to be the average. And if that's a sinking boat, okay. But if you can tell that it's sinking, you know, you can get off. And work from home is a revolution for women. You know, it's, so things are so much better, I think, than, you know, I suppose it's more marketable to be negative and sort of blast the sirens all the time. But it's a good time to be alive. It's a good time to be a woman. It's a good time to push back and be countercultural, because I know that God is on our side. And I believe that the tides are turning as well.
I agree, Helen. I just want to say I'm so grateful for your show. I've been following you, as I told you, for a couple of years. And you know, people like you are making such a huge difference. I mean, you're right here at the hinge of young people starting to wake up and demand something different and something better than what they have been sold. And so thank you so much for being a voice for that.
I really appreciate that. I am going to take that with me and keep it in my back pocket. I so appreciate your words. And you know, for the audience, I've already done enough just fawning over this novel. I absolutely loved it. And I can't encourage everyone enough to just go buy it, actually. So, Maya, could you let them know what the best way to acquire this beautiful work of art is?
Sure. So it's called The City Mother. And it's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It's available directly from the publisher, Chrism Press, C-H-R-I-S-M Press. They're a great, great indie Catholic publisher. Their works have a lot of appeal for everybody. And so if you really want to be a hero, you will order it directly from their website. I think they get a little more that way. But really, it's easy to buy on Amazon or anywhere else.
Yes, I like to buy directly from the publisher. It's a good way to support the little guy. And so you guys all should do that. And Maya, it was such an honor to speak to you. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much, Helen.